current surge because people are more experienced, right? But we don't have a control over care.
We have pathology. 10 seconds, Paul.
We don't have a control over care system here. We have containment nihilism, giving up on containment too early.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, and there's so much more to discuss. I encourage people to read Dr. Paul Farmer's book, Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola, and the Ravages of History. He's an infectious disease doc. He is a medical anthropologist. He is chair of global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School, co-founder and chief strategist of Partners in Health, also featured in the documentary Bending of the Arc. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be part of Willamette Week GiveGuide this year. When you support KBOO through GiveGuide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives a little back to you in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last, so donate to KBOO on GiveGuide today at kboo.fm/give. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of Holding the Thin Green Line. This documentary slideshow tells the stories of people fighting to save the souls of their communities and preserve the integrity of the Pacific Northwest, as they fight to stop the world's largest methanol refinery from being built in Conemaugh, Washington, and a massive LNG facility in Tacoma. From December 6th to the 11th, the slideshow can be viewed at your own convenience at kboo.fm/greenline. Then on December 11th from 5 to 6 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with activists who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's Holding the Thin Green Line documentary slideshow screening, December 6th to the 11th, and a live Zoom Q&A on December 11th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Brown warns that the pandemic will only get worse in the days and weeks to come. Commissioner Fritz has removed General Custer's name from a popular Southwest Portland park, and unemployment claims are again on the rise in Oregon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 4th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. According to data compiled by the Oregon Health Authority, the three counties that make up the city of Portland all saw coronavirus positivity surge to nearly 10% in November. The positivity rate shows the percentage of those tested who tested positive for the virus. State guidelines call for a county's positivity rate to drop to 5% for businesses to reopen. Health officials indicated that Oregonians appear to be taking precautions in public, but remain concerned that some precautions may not have been taken during family gatherings at Thanksgiving. Today, the state reported a staggering 2,176 new COVID cases and 30 deaths. Officials are bracing for an even bigger surge in the coming weeks. Hospitals in Portland have already been hit hard. On Wednesday, Providence Healthcare reported that they were treating 82 COVID patients and were in the process of converting 100 additional beds to handle the expected increase in admissions. Yesterday, Legacy Health reported that they were caring for 116 COVID patients in their Salmon Creek and Portland hospitals and are halting non-essential surgeries to make room for additional COVID patients. But it's not just a question of available beds. Skilled staff are stretched thin as well. Providence has advised staff to prepare for, quote, an unprecedented surge of COVID-19 patients, and Becky Holtberg of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems said, quote, staffing is constrained across the country, so it's difficult to bring in staff from outside the state. We are really struggling to ensure that we have adequate staffing in all of our hospitals. In what is becoming a Friday tradition, Governor Kate Brown held a press conference today to provide Oregonians with the latest COVID-19 updates. After referencing the new risk and safety framework, she painted a grim picture about the latest case numbers before moving on to the potential impact of the recently announced vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer.
This week, our statewide two-week freeze ended, and our new risk and safety framework launched. The majority of the state has moved into the extreme risk level, which means the virus is still widespread across 25 counties. These counties remained under very strict restrictions. We are not out of this crisis yet. I know it's hard to imagine, but in fact, our hardest days still lie ahead. Today, unfortunately, we have a record number of infections again, more than 2,100 cases, and sadly, 30 deaths. The fourth straight day of double-digit deaths in Oregon from this virus. Our new modeling confirms our worst fears that this pandemic can indeed get much worse before we get the majority of our population vaccinated, and it likely will. But what we know is that it's certainly possible that by Christmas, we will be reporting more than double the case rates we are seeing now. And we just need you to hold on a little bit longer, because hope is on the way. There are two vaccines on the precipice of FDA approval. In line with CDC guidance, we will be prioritizing frontline healthcare workers and long-term care residents and employees as the first group to receive the vaccine. This includes our doctors, nurses, janitorial staff, and others who have the potential for direct or indirect contact with COVID-19 patients or infectious materials. The introduction of a vaccine, however, doesn't end this pandemic. Right now and into the foreseeable future, the only way to reduce transmission and slow the spread is to take safety precautions until the vaccine is both widely available and widely administered. And this is going to take time.
In addition to healthcare workers, the governor stressed that marginalized communities that have been hit particularly hard by the pandemic will also be prioritized. Earlier this week, the Oregon Health Authority announced that the state is scheduled to receive over 35,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine on December 15th and upwards of 72,000 doses from Moderna on December 22nd. These numbers are roughly three times the expected 30,000 doses OHA was hoping to receive before the end of the year. The most recent patient trials are showing that both vaccines are 95% effective in preventing the novel coronavirus following the administration of two doses. In accord with the federal emergency approval process, Oregon will conduct a joint safety review of the vaccines with neighboring states before moving forward with inoculations. A judge in Oregon is urging that criminal defendants be immunized to enable quicker judicial action. According to Willamette Week, U.S. District Court Judge Marco Hernandez sent a letter to federal and state officials suggesting that, quote, access to justice should be taken into consideration when determining how to distribute the COVID vaccine. The letter was addressed to James Duff, director of the Administrative Office of the United States Courts, and copied to Governor Kate Brown, U.S. Attorney Billy Williams, and all the senators and representatives of Oregon's congressional delegation in D.C. Hernandez wrote, quote, vaccination will facilitate a defendant's participation in the justice system at a very basic level by allowing a defendant to meet with an attorney or appear for a proceeding without risking infection. The judge went on to say that he was not advocating a direction, but simply asking that his suggestion be taken into consideration during discussions about distribution of the vaccine. In late November, it was reported that federal prison staff would be among the first to receive the vaccinations, but there was no mention of when prisoners would have access. In Oregon, 1,402 inmates and 402 prison staff have tested positive since the start of the pandemic, according to Department of Corrections data. 18 prisoners have died after testing positive. Tracking the spread of COVID-19 in Oregon may soon get easier. A new smartphone app designed by Apple and Google Technologies will use Bluetooth to alert you when you've been in close contact to someone who has tested positive for coronavirus. People with iPhones will need to enable the exposure notifications feature on their device, while Android users will need to install the app. An early version of the app has already been under scrutiny at the Corvallis and Bend campuses of Oregon State University. Users who have tested positive for COVID-19 can submit their status, and the app will distribute that data to all possible contact sources without revealing personal information. Earlier this week, Washington State introduced the app, joining a dozen other states. At its introduction, Washington Governor Jay Inslee said, quote, this will allow for more people to get the testing and care they need quickly. Despite initial privacy concerns, approximately 9,000 OSU participants are involved in the trials, which are expected to last through mid-December. The COVID notification app is expected to launch in Oregon in early January, but people who work or travel in Washington State frequently can download that state's version of the app at any time. Unemployment claims are on the rise again in Oregon. Over 17,000 new claims were filed during the last 2 weeks of November, compared with 6,000 filings during a similar period in October. Many of the filings came from service workers in restaurants, bars, and gyms who were impacted by Governor Brown's freeze order in November. The Oregon Employment Department forecasted that the order could affect over 50,000 jobs. And although the governor's freeze expired on Wednesday, many restrictions remain in place under the new risk and safety guidelines, and many who lost their jobs at the start of the freeze have not yet been called back to work. And it may get worse before it gets better. As many as 70,000 unemployed Oregonians are at risk of losing some or all of their benefits when two federal jobless benefits expire the day after Christmas. The benefits were part of the CARES Act passed earlier this year, but at this point, the Republican-controlled Senate has shown little interest in extending the act or providing additional relief. Nationally, the Labor Department announced that the United States only added 245,000 jobs in November. This was about 200,000 less than expected and a drastic reduction from the gain of more than 600,000 jobs that was recorded in October. Experts agree that November's numbers signal economic disaster this coming winter as the coronavirus pandemic enters its 10th month. As cases of the novel coronavirus surge across the nation and businesses shutter their doors due to increased restrictions, American hiring has taken a significant step back. While the U.S. unemployment rate dropped to 6.7% in November, the availability of new jobs decreased for the fifth month in a row. Job openings can be used to predict future economic growth and stability. December typically sees job growth nationwide due to seasonal openings in retail, food, and beverage. These sectors reported some of the highest job losses in November, indicating the usual December upswing might not happen this year. New data also revealed staggering growth in long-term unemployment, which is defined as 27 or more weeks without work. Last month, the number of long-term unemployed Americans grew to 3.9 million, or nearly 40% of all unemployed people. Systemically marginalized communities continue to be disproportionately affected by the economic downturn, with Black and Latino workers unemployed at significantly higher rates than whites. When asked for a time frame for America's economic recovery, Daniel Zhao, an economist with Glassdoor, said, quote, "Ultimately, the virus is in the driver's seat. The virus is what determines the trajectory of the recovery." On Wednesday evening, retiring City Commissioner Amanda Fritz announced her intention to rename Custer Park in Southwest Portland. The outgoing Parks and Recreation Bureau Director announced that the new name will simply be A Park until a suitable replacement can be agreed upon. The park had been named after the infamous General George Armstrong Custer. Critics have long noted that in the wars against Native Americans, Custer was guilty of what is considered war crimes. In a statement, Fritz said that the name, quote, glorifies a military oppressor instead of honoring the courageous Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors who defended their homelands in what is now Montana. Fritz said renaming the park will allow the public space to better represent Portlanders and their values, and that over the next year, the Bureau will, quote, work with neighbors, community stakeholders, historians, and Indigenous peoples to choose an appropriate and honorable name. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect a clear and cold evening with an overnight low in the high 30s. A stagnant air quality alert is in effect until 10 a.m. tomorrow. And tomorrow, we can look forward to a generally sunny day with the possibility of showers in the early evening and an afternoon high in the upper 40s. On this day in 1978, San Francisco got its first female mayor when city supervisor Dianne Feinstein was named to replace George Moscone. Moscone and supervisor Harvey Milk were assassinated by former supervisor Dan White. Today's quote is from Harvey Milk, the first openly gay man to be elected to a high public office in the U.S. Milk said, quote, "If every gay person were to come out only to their own family, friends, neighbors, and fellow workers, within days, the entire state would discover that we are not the stereotypes generally assumed." Yesterday saw another legal setback in the president's efforts to nullify the election. With more on that story and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We've been letting the process play out for weeks, and the president and his allies have not been successful in any of their legal efforts.
Michael Beckel is with the National Council on Election Integrity. So far, over 36 Trump campaign lawsuits have failed. Yesterday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court declined to accept one more. They still have two other Trump lawsuits pending. Trump's own administration officials, including Attorney General William Barr, have acknowledged that the 2020 elections were safe, transparent, free, and fair, noting any errors found would not affect the outcome of the election. Reports emerged Thursday that President Trump is now considering firing Barr. Beckel says efforts to undermine the election results have gone on long enough.
Now is really the time for the president to accept the election results.
A former U.S. attorney for Georgia has asked the state to investigate Republican Senator Lindsey Graham for allegedly trying to interfere in the state's election, pressuring election officials to throw out valid ballots. On the flip side, Texas Congressman Michael Cloud and other Republican members of the House Freedom Caucus held a press conference yesterday demanding that Barr release the Justice Department findings from their investigations into the allegations of 2020 election fraud.
There's been a lot of talk about trying to overturn an election. Let me tell you, nobody wants to overturn an election. What we want to do is reveal what's true in the election. We want to make sure that our elections are secure, that our elections are accurate.
The nation is watching Georgia now, and a Florida lawyer is at the center of a new election investigation there. In a now-deleted video on Facebook, Panama City attorney Bill Price told a Republican group he was moving in with his brother in Georgia so he could register to vote in the runoff election. He urged others to join him and register as well. To actually do so without intending to stay would be illegal. President Trump is scheduled to be there tomorrow, rallying support for the two Republicans facing runoff Senate races. In response to Trump's attacks on state elections officials who defended their election results, a group of former Georgia GOP leaders jointly urged the party to unite and focus on protecting their Senate majority. Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden tapped Brian Deese to head the National Economic Council. Deese worked with President Barack Obama on the auto bailout and the Paris Climate Accords.
I'm proud to work for a president who knows that we need to go far beyond the Paris Agreement.
Deese is not a favorite among many climate activists. He worked at BlackRock, which holds financial stakes in conventional energy companies. Biden is also revealing more about his plans to tackle COVID-19. Biden told CNN he asked Dr. Anthony Fauci to stay on as the White House chief medical advisor. The president-elect also said he will ask Americans to wear masks for his first 100 days in office. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Tribes are responding after heavy rains unleashed landslides in Haines, Alaska, earlier this week. At least two people are still missing. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two people were still missing Thursday in Haines, Alaska after landslides this week. KHNS reports four of six people thought to be missing have been accounted for. Emergency response is underway in the community. Landslides triggered by rain destroyed homes and displaced community members. Local groups are among those offering assistance. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes is coordinating efforts with the Chilku Indian Association to provide food, clothing, and shelter, and have set up funding apps for donations. The state's also working to provide additional resources and assistance to Haines. The Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux Tribal Executive Board in Northeast Montana reinstated the tribe's suspended chairman following a December 3rd vote. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports.
During a special public board meeting, attorney Georgette Boggio read nine charges from the Tribal Executive Board against Chairman Floyd Azur, which led to his suspension on November 5th.
The chairman has acted to create division and violate his oath to serve the best interests of the tribe.
One of the charges was that Chairman Azur had refused to attend board meetings since August 24th, and another was that he inappropriately tried to maintain and pay for services from a close associate's construction company, BP Construction, even after the board entered into litigation with the same company for failing to provide services. During his response, Azur said the board was being, quote, unfair, and he denied all allegations, saying he was fulfilling his role as chairman.
Whether you guys like me or not, I don't care. It's not my job to be liked in this office, but I'm not here to make friends.
After hearing the charges and Azur's defense, 7 of the 11 tribal executive board members voted to remove the chairman. 8 votes were required for Azur's removal. Emerson Young, one of the board members who voted to remove Azur, said the board and the chairman needed to be a united front moving forward.
It was hard, hard working with you. But, you know, it is what it is. Now, let's be the better people and work for the best of this tribe. Move forward. Let's work as one.
When board member Patricia Ironcloud Runsthrough began urging Azur to retract critical opinion articles he had published about the board in the Fort Peck Journal, the chairman stood up, said the decision had already been made to reinstate him, and left before the board adjourned. The Tribal Executive Board will continue its ongoing litigation against BP Construction. Azur was reinstated as chairman immediately after the vote. I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
The Canadian government says it will not be able to keep its pledge to lift all long-term drinking water advisories in First Nations. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the government and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had promised to do so by March of 2021.
Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller says he takes full responsibility for the broken promise. He also pledged to spend more than $1.5 billion to make sure that the work gets done. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had promised during the 2015 election campaign to end all long-term boil water advisories within 5 years. Miller acknowledged that the original plan was an ambitious one, adding that there were many reasons for the delay, but he renewed the government's pledge going forward.
For every community with a long-term drinking water advisory, there is a project team and an action plan in place to resolve it. What communities want is not an Ottawa-imposed deadline. It's a long-term commitment to access the clean water. For this, they need funding to support measures such as training and retention of qualified staff and support for the daily operations and maintenance activities, which is critical to ensuring the lasting effects of these investments.
Some First Nations have said a permanent fix for their communities could take years. So far, Ottawa has helped lift 97 long-term drinking water advisories in the past 5 years. More than 50 are still in place. But Miller says by the end of this month, the number left could shrink to 12. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Montana's Crazy Mountains are sacred to the Crow tribe, and a new plan will increase wilderness protection. For more on that, here's Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service.
Tribal advocacy helped push the U.S. Forest Service to protect parts of Montana's Crazy Mountains. Tribal members and conservation groups believe the agency should go even further. The Custer-Gallatin National Forest Plan likely will be released in early 2021. It includes wilderness protections for a small portion of the Crazies, a sacred mountain range for the Crow tribe. Shane Doyle of the tribe says he and fellow Crow see the Crazies as a place to be cherished and respected.
The cultural value of the range puts it into a historical context that all Montanans and really people all over the world will be allowed to appreciate in a way that really celebrates the significance of that range.
Doyle says he is pleased with the plan overall, but he submitted an objection on behalf of the Crow Tribe Executive Branch, which the Forest Service is currently evaluating alongside other objections. Emily Cleveland with the Montana Wilderness Association says tribal advocacy was key for the protections these mountains are receiving. They're considered an area of tribal importance, but she says the plan could better capture what makes the range culturally significant.
When it's really vague and just says the Crazies are important culturally to the Crow tribe, that doesn't provide a lot of context for managers on how to make sure that that cultural significance is maintained.
Cleveland would like to see the plan prohibit motorized and mechanized recreation, such as mountain biking, in the proposed Crazy Mountains backcountry area, which would be about 28,000 acres. Under its current management, the area doesn't allow motorized or mechanized use. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
With one of the highest coronavirus infection rates in the country, North Dakotans are facing a mountain of medical debt. But the CARES Act and other mechanisms may provide some relief before people are forced to declare bankruptcy as a last resort. For more on that, here's Mike Moen with the Public News Service.
As COVID-19 hospitalizations grow, so do the medical bills at a time of economic struggle for many families. But people can take steps to shield themselves from insurmountable debt. North Dakota health officials say overall coronavirus cases are slowing, but hospitalizations remain at near record levels. The Federal CARES Act allows for people who are uninsured to avoid paying for COVID-related treatment. But Rich LeMay of Legal Services of North Dakota says hospitals aren't required to tell patients, and some don't readily provide the information. And when a patient is admitted, they don't often think to inquire about the final bill.
Somebody gets sick, somebody gets injured. That's not the first thing they're thinking about. They're concentrating on maybe one, staying alive, and two, getting healthy again.
Generally speaking, LeMay says people facing heavy debt can apply for programs like Medicaid, which can provide 3 months of coverage retroactively. He adds if bills have been sent to creditors, it's important to read and keep all the documents, making it easier to navigate any legal action. A 2019 report from the Urban Institute found 9% of North Dakotans had medical debt in collections. And there are fears that percentage will grow as more people have needed hospitalization in recent months. LeMay says when the bills arrive, try to work with medical providers to establish a plan that won't leave you drowning in debt.
You can negotiate, you can develop payment plans, you can do all kinds of things to try to reach some type of settlement.
He says filing for bankruptcy is a last resort as it affects more than your medical debt. Other balances, such as credit cards, would be included, even if you wanted to leave those untouched in a bankruptcy filing. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
In Oregon, abortion rights are protected by state law, even if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. But 10 states have trigger laws that would automatically outlaw abortion in the wake of such a SCOTUS ruling, and those that do not are preparing for an influx of patients from other states if that happens. With more on that, here's Lily Bolke with the Public News Service.
Reproductive health providers in Illinois are preparing for an influx of patients if the 6-3 conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court overturns the Roe v. Wade decision. 10 states currently have abortion, quote, trigger laws, meaning abortion bans or restrictions that are unenforceable now, but designed to go into effect if constitutional precedent changes. Brandi Collins-Calhoun with the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy says if trigger laws in surrounding states go into effect, local Illinois abortion funds would be stretched thin with more out-of-state patients who would also have travel and lodging expenses and lost wages.
We're seeing clinics require a 2-week quarantine for out-of-state patients right now because of COVID. So with Illinois, they'll be well over their capacity of funding and support once the trigger laws go into effect.
She says the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy is preparing a resource toolkit to direct more philanthropic support to reproductive rights funds in states like Illinois, where policymakers have taken steps to protect access without relying on the Roe decision. In 2017, Illinois lawmakers repealed a trigger law and passed a requirement for Medicaid to cover pregnancy termination. And last year, they passed the Reproductive Health Act, guaranteeing reproductive rights as fundamental rights. Bridget Leahy with Planned Parenthood Illinois says providers are figuring out how to coordinate with affiliates in neighboring states.
So that patients can be referred, that their medical records are following them, and that there's a transition and a continuity of care when they go back home.
Leahy says the goal is to make sure women in Illinois and elsewhere can connect with the financial and emotional support they need in these situations.